You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, which may be the last independent bookstore within a radius of 100 miles. So stop by and buy a book so my children can eat. Today our guest is John Ronson. John has written books. We're really happy to have John with us. John has written books you are already familiar with. Them, Adventures with Extremists, The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was a great movie, and his last was The Psychopath Test. Today we're going to be talking to him about his new book, Lost at Sea, which was just published, I guess, last month. And
it was.
So anyway, John, welcome. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. Hello. So I guess to start with, I guess, you know, your writing style, which people have labeled with all kinds of labels like gonzo and things like that, you seem to embed yourself, you don't seem to, you do embed yourself in almost all of your work as if you're almost a character in one of your own novels. And I don't even know, like at Lost at Sea, most of these essays appeared in The Guardian.
Lost at Sea, everything's appeared in different forms in different places. I couldn't help myself when I was editing the book. I couldn't help myself taking out all the jokes that were, in retrospect, bad, and then adding a bunch of new thoughts. So it's not, you know, so it's new in a sense. But but it's a collection. It's an anthology.
Well, it's kind of cool because in that one essay, you know, about the Jesus Christians, when you talk about you actually published it and then you were able to go back and say what happened after it was published.
Yes.
That was
That was a dark and difficult situation. That was one of the most difficult situations I think I've ever been in as a journalist, because me and the guy I was writing about grew to absolutely hate each other. And that's quite an unusual situation. And I found it quite discombobulating, because I really like to empathize with my readers and for us to go with my subjects and for us to go on a kind of journey together, and it could be a kind of absurd and slightly difficult relationship, but not out and out hate. But that one was out and out hate.
That one was scary, and the way you described it is scary, which made me think about, you know, like a lot of your I don't want to call them essays, because they're not really essays. What do you call them?
I think of them as kind of adventure stories.
Yeah.
Mystery adventure stories. Obviously all true and all about things that matter. But I like them to be kind of funny, unfolding, maybe narrative nonfiction. People use that term sometimes.
Well, especially
unfolding
with
adventures.
Especially with you being inside of them all the time. So we're always kind of inside your head, which is good or bad?
Yeah, no, quite often bad if you're actually me. But you know what? I think it helps. I think if I'm going into some kind of crazy world, a world that isn't familiar to people, I think it's good to have me as, you know, as a essentially sane traveler for the readers to, you know, to see the world through my eyes. And obviously that's a kind of staple of literature from the beginning, that a newcomer, you know, that a story is told to a newcomer into a world. So it kind of works because, you know, the readers are newcomers into the world too. So, and I think people like the fact that I'm, you know, honest about my anxieties and frailties, and I think people kind of enjoy that. And also, I think people like, sort of rather sadistically like seeing me panic and get completely out of my depth. You know, I'm like the worst person to undertake dangerous adventures because...
Yeah, you have a lot of courage. And you know what I really... You know, one of the favorite lines of your book, the guy that ended up hating you, who said you had a dark soul, and you said... No, that was... what's her face? Sylvia...
Sylvia Brown, the wicked psychic. She called me a worm.
She's
and a dark
pain,
soul.
Pain in the ass. But anyway, she said you had a very dark soul, and you said, I knew then that she wasn't a psychic because I have a very light soul. And it made me think what a good person you are.
Well, thank you. Well, she's a terrible person. It's not often that I interview people who I can say, you know, they're just terrible, but she was one. So she's a psychic, but And, you know, obviously psychics are fine when they don't cause any trouble. But this one, she goes on television, and parents of missing kids, you know, who are suffering, you know, terrible, terrible traumas and tragedies, go to her at the end of their tether and say, you know, what happened to my kids, Sylvia? You know, I've asked everybody, and I, you know, can you tell me? And she'll just go, oh, your kid's dead. And she kind of tends to always get it wrong. It's like if she tells you that your kid's dead, you can pretty much guarantee your kid's, you know, just down at the shops.
Well, the worst, how did you get that? Well, this happens on a cruise that you booked. This is what I mean. You're kind of courageous. You booked this cruise, but you got off of it early. But yeah. She tells that one poor girl in the audience, you'll be dead in 2 years.
Yeah, I'm like, it seems like if she wakes up in a bad mood, then like everyone's going to be dead, you know, by the end of the month. And if she wakes up in a good mood, then you know, parents are going to be reconciled with kids. The lump on the breast is benign. It's like a complete, you know, her psychic prediction seems to be. Sometimes it feels like her psychic predictions are completely down to what kind of mood she's in that day.
Well, the problem I would love to do what you do, and I guess in my life I do some of it because for a long time, whenever I wrote my signature, my name is Samuel Hanken. I don't have a middle initial. So I would write Samuel X. Hanken to see what mail I would get, and I'm still getting mail 20 years later every once in a while for Samuel X. Hanken.
Wow. It's funny, isn't it? So you live on lists. And things somewhere like we all do.
Yeah, and what I'm talking about is John, one of his stories is about, you know, people who get constantly get inundated with offers for credit, and the people who get them are the people who should least likely get them.
Yeah, and I proved it with a devious experiment, which was basically I created a number of personas and I gave them all completely different personalities. So Paul, they were called John, Paul, George Ringo, Dave, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch. Now Americans probably won't recognize that reference. That's like a crazy old band from the 60s in England. And Biff, Happy, Bernard, their characters in Death of a Salesman. Anyway, so I created these characters and gave them all completely different personalities and signed them up to various different mailing lists. Never financial. That was my rule. It had to be anything but financial because I wanted to see which of these personas was going to get blasted with credit card junk mail. So Paul Ronson only signed up for like Porsche and airport lounges and kind of high society stuff. And Happy Ronson was very ethical. Only signed up for like Peter and the body shop and so on. And Titch Ronson was a venal pervert who was only into Nazism, bare-knuckle boxing, pornography, and gambling. Anyway, he obviously, Titch Ronson, was the one who was inundated with credit card junk mail, getting pre-approved loans from Morgan Stanley and American Express. And so those are the people who were most attractive to the credit card companies.
Well, aren't you going to keep getting mail for the rest of your life now, though?
Yeah, I am. I'm like one of those, you know those journalists who have to become a heroin addict to get in with the drug cartels and then can't kick the habit. I'm like that with Titch Ronson. I'm constantly getting mail for Titch.
It's like
Titch
when
is constantly getting loans.
It's like when I think it was Marielle Hemingway got a breast implant for a movie she was in, and I thought, wow, that's kind of over the top, isn't it, so to speak.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Okay, I like to see myself less like Marielle Hemingway, more like Kiefer Sutherland in 24, when he had to get the triad tattoo so he could infiltrate the triads. That's me. I'm like Kiefer Sutherland in 24.
Well, the thing is that that story is a good one because it makes you laugh, especially, you know, John, Paul, George, and Ringo and things like that. And that's where you embed yourself and you're really happy and like the guy's name and you're amused. But the story is a very tragic one.
Yes. And for me, that is, you know, that's the key. If I can take something very dark and very serious and something that really matters and really affects people's lives and it's about some kind of injustice or exploitation, but kind of throw all the rules out the window of how you would normally tell those stories and tell them as a almost like a sometimes, you know, slapstick, sometimes absurd, unfolding adventure story, a comedy.
Well,
for me, if those things can, you know, if I can take those two very incompatible things and make them work together, that to me is a good story.
The perfect example in America right now is the Petraeus affair. I can't stop laughing about it.
Right.
And I shouldn't be on Facebook in the first place, but I keep posting pictures of his wife, who's this very unattractive woman, and then Broadwell, which is a great name, and the book All In is, like, perfect, and she was embedded, which is perfect. And then there's these twins, and one's an evil twin. It's like you couldn't have written this as a screenplay and ever succeeded with it because it's just too absurd. But it's so humorous, yet it's ruining the lives of lots and lots of people. But it's hilarious.
And I suppose, you know, the reason why that's a compelling story is because it's happening, you know, at the heart of secret government, at the heart of, you know, I was raised to believe by my, you know, conservative father that the people up above us were the rational, sane ones, and we down below were the irrational ones wandering around like chickens with their heads cut off. But, you know, as pretty much every single one of my books demonstrates, the minister goes, the psychopath test, our leaders are not rational and they're not driven by sensible, sane thought processes. And I think that's why, you know, that story has become so compelling, because it's another example of that. I think people are really beginning to, you know, to mistrust the shadowy places at the top of government. And it's interesting. It's a new thing, I think, this kind of mistrust. I suppose it was there in the 60s as well.
Well, it's like when you were saying about why you had credit card debt because you're lazy and stupid, which is exactly the same as me. But if you think about, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Tiger Woods, the nitwit congressman who tweeted the semi-nude images of himself, they really are incredibly stupid. And my theory is that they should all have, like, a guy. And the guy should be someone they knew in third grade who's not starstruck by them. And the guy should always go around with them and say, like, to Mel Gibson, hey, Mel, when you get out of the car, make sure you don't say to the cops a whole bunch of really anti-Semitic things, okay?
Right. Well, and it's so interesting. I mean, personally, I'm glad all these things happen because they make the world a more interesting place. And what I like to try and do, so, you know, as long as nobody's getting hurt and nobody's getting exploited, is sort of empathize with the people who are spiraling out of control and try and see it as something, you know, to try and cherish about humanity. Our instincts, every time, you know, somebody acts crazily, and I do this as much as anybody, is to kind of, you know, form a gang on Twitter so we can all laugh at them. And I do, obviously, like everybody, take huge pleasure in doing that. But I always feel a bit bad about it. I always think, wouldn't it be better if people were slightly more, you know, if we were all more empathetic and more open about our own irrationalities?
Well, it's not going to happen.
Right. Well, it's not easy, right?
Well, look, the thing about, okay, say, take the, say, so you want to be a millionaire, that story, which is about a scandal in England when they were cheating by people coughing in the audience in a strategic fashion. That's how this guy won. But the funniest thing in that story, and I went to, I don't know why I went to the Outback to eat by myself when I was reading your book, but I'm sitting there and I'm reading where the guy's saying, you've not fallen off my mental list, and I'm mentally logging that, and then I've logged it up here, pointing at his head, and I'm laughing out loud.
So frustrating.
I'm laughing out loud, and all these people are looking at me.
You've not fallen off my mental list yet. He was a terrible man. Basically, I was trying to wheedle my way into these people's affections, these people who are on trial for cheating, who wants to be a millionaire, and suddenly they appointed, I think for my benefit, they appointed a press man who became this kind of barrier between me and the people I wanted to write about. And that's the worst thing for any journalist, is to have some kind of barrier, some kind of handler. And he was extremely unwilling to bend an inch for me.
I like it when you start out and people like you, and then they start looking at you worryingly, and then they start looking at you like they're terrified.
I know. I feel terrible about it when that happens, of course. But I guess the best thing to do is, and sometimes it even kind of embarrasses me, but because I feel like I've, you know, acted badly or whatever. But the thing to do is to just be very, very open about it, I think, in the stories. And the more open you are about your failings, I think the funnier it is. And the more power it gives you, actually. People who are so afraid of being ashamed and humiliated, they're the ones who are most likely to be ashamed and to be shamed and humiliated. If you're completely open about all your failings, that sort of robs the people who want to humiliate you of their power.
It does. So everything that's inside of quotes is actually has been said, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, here's one that you didn't, that I kind of like felt, okay, why didn't John say this? And it was, it was the Bina episode where you went talking to, it was like a Turing test. You went talking to the supposed artificial intelligences, which you debunked each and every one of them in a somewhat, I don't know, subliminal way almost in that story. But when you said, when Bina didn't know her own name, and you said, this is an extraordinarily bad oversight, but it's not, but it's not in quotes. Why didn't you say that, actually?
Why didn't I say it? You know what? I'd only just met them, and I was being polite. Funnily enough, you saying that, when I read the audio book of Lost at Sea for Audible, I think the same thought went through my head. I thought, why didn't I say it? But I think I'd just met the guy, and I didn't want to, you know, he took himself seriously, and I didn't want to, you know, make fun so early on in our relationship. I think that was probably the reason.
Yeah, I guess when you read it in the audiobook, you can't tell what it's said aloud
or not.
Have you ever read the book by, I guess he's your countryman, I guess he's British, though, Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome?
You know, I read it when I was at school, but I don't even, I can barely remember the name of my school, let alone the content of the books I had to read.
Well, there's a part of it, or a lot of it, that's exactly like you, so you should reread it, because it must have informed you in some way. But I wanted to read something from it to you, but it'll take around 3 minutes. Can I do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. This is, because this is exactly you, and it's also exactly me.
Okay.
I'll cut out some of it. I remember... I remember going to the British Museum one day to read up the treatment for some slight ailment of which I had a touch. Hay fever, I fancy it was. I got down the book and read all I came to read, and then in an unthinking moment I idly turned the leaves and began to indolently study diseases generally. I forgot which was the first distemper I plunged into, some fearful, devastating scourge I know, and before I had glanced half down the list of premonitory symptoms, it was borne in upon me that I had fairly got it. I sat for a while frozen with horror, and then, in the listlessness of despair, I again turned over the pages. I came to typhoid fever, read the symptoms, discovered that I had typhoid fever, must have had it for months without knowing it, wondered what else I had got, turned up St. Vitus's dance, found as I expected that I had that too, began to get interested in my case, and determined to sift it to the bottom, and alphabetically read up ague and learned that I was sickening for it, and that the acute stage would commence in about another fortnight. Bright's disease, I was relieved to find I had only in a modified form, and so far as that was concerned, I might live for years. Cholera I had with severe complications, and diphtheria I seemed to have been born with. I plotted conscientiously through the 26 letters, and the only malady I could conclude I had not got was housemaid's knee. He's upset that he doesn't have housemaid's knee then. He gets, why, you know, I should have that too. So he goes to his doctor, who's his buddy. He wondered how long he had to live, and he pulled out his watch and timed his pulse, and it was 147 to the minute. Then he tried to feel his heart, and he couldn't feel it. He said it stopped beating. So
that's wonderful.
He goes, I went to my medical man. He's an old chum of mine. So I went and said to him, and he goes, what's the matter with you? He said, I will not take up your time, dear boy, with telling you what is the matter with me. Life is brief, and you might pass away before I had finished. But I will tell you what is not the matter with me. I have not got housemaid's knee. Why I have not got housemaid's knee, I cannot tell you. But the fact remains that I have not got it. Everything else, however, I have got. So the doctor writes down a prescription, which he doesn't open. He takes it to the chemist, hands it. The man reads it, and he says, I don't keep these things. And the guy says, you're a chemist? He says, I am a chemist. If I was a cooperative stores and family hotel combined, I might be able to oblige you. Being only a chemist hampers me. So he reads the prescription and says, 1 pound beefsteak with 1 pint bitter beer, 1 10-mile walk every morning, 1 bet at 11 sharp every night, and don't stuff up your head with things you don't understand.
That's wonderful. I can see you're absolutely right. That's a man after my heart.
Well, it's like the one, and this is, there's a couple of ones where you actually almost wistfully kind of believe in what they are. Like when you're talking about the motivational speaker and the guy comes up to you and he whisks away your anxiety that you feel when you're abroad about something horrible happening to your children. And you do believe it because
I
it hasn't happened.
I do believe it. And you know what? To this day, I believe it. Now, this is a good hypnotist. A guy called Paul McKenna. And he was in partnership, I think still is in partnership, with very troubled but kind of brilliant in a sort of way, but also really crazy and difficult guy called Richard Bandler, who is the co-inventor of neuro-linguistic programming, which is, you know, a huge deal everywhere. NLP, you know, salesmen use it, and Al Gore, you know, has been a fan, and Bill Clinton's been a fan. It's a massive, massive thing. But yeah, I had 45 minutes for Paul McKenna, and I thought, well, I can either interview him, or I can get him to cure me of my belief that whenever I'm away from home and I can't get my wife on the phone, I'm convinced that she's dead. I have these very detailed scenarios that she's fallen down the stairs, and my son, when he was a baby anyway, would be, as I was phoning, would be reaching up for the flecks of a just boiled kettle. These terrible, terrible scenarios. So yeah, Paul McKenna cured me of it. What can I tell you? I mean, I'm still a paranoid wreck, but I'm not paranoid about that particular thing anymore. Now, if I can't get hold of my wife when I'm away, I don't worry about it at all. So it just goes to show that some of these new age techniques, you know, can be beneficial for people.
It just seems like, you know, doesn't it seem like to you when something like that happens, I mean, you've written so much and so many columns and so many books, when that happens, does it kind of make you feel like, I can't say it. What have I been doing? It turns out this guy's right, and I've been debunking
everyone.
Yeah,
well, I mean, in this particular instance, the thing about NLP is that it's a mishmash of stuff that does work and stuff that I think doesn't work. And the stuff that does work, you know, has been proven to work in other disciplines. So, for instance, they use CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which I think really does work for a lot of people. And hypnotism. Now, I didn't kind of realize this about hypnotism, but, you know, even the most hardened skeptic will say hypnotism does work for people. But the problem with NLP is that it takes a lot of these very effective things and shoves in a whole load of nonsense as well, about, you know, you can read a person's mind from their eye movements and so on, you know, all of which I think is kind of hokum.
Well, it all goes back to the men who stare at goats, and it all goes back to the psychopath test. And
yeah, absolutely. Well, in fact, there's a very particular men who stare at goats connection with that story, because the U.S. military was bringing in a whole load of gurus in the 70s to try and teach the soldier to be more, you know, paranormally brilliant. And some of the gurus were trying to teach them to kill goats just by staring at them. This is done in Fort Bragg. To walk through walls, to become invisible. And Richard Bandler, the co-inventor of NLP, was brought in to teach. What he says he did is that he taught a young kid to be a world-class sniper in seconds by modeling. There's this thing called modeling, which is basically a kind of, you know, a kind of fancy way of imitating a real sniper. So he actually was, Richard Bandler kind of was, in a way, one of the men who stared at goats.
Yes, that was funny too, because you said it was a young girl, and then when you interview him, he goes, it wasn't a girl, it was a boy.
it was a boy, but nonetheless, I got the rest of it right.
Yeah, he goes, you can get a 10-year-old boy to do anything.
Yeah, it's kind of impressive, right? I don't know if it's true. I saw this modelling thing. The idea of modelling is you don't need to study. This is an NLP idea. You don't need to study, you know, some discipline for 20 years. All you need to do is look closely at how somebody who has studied this discipline for 20 years does it and just, you know, model them, and you can immediately have what they have. I mean, that's their philosophy. And I saw it at work, actually, in a very simple way when I was doing NLP. I saw a really overweight guy ask Paul McKenna, you know, how he could lose weight. And Paul McKenna said, well, if you study people who aren't overweight, they always leave a little bit of food on their plate. So model that, always leave a little bit of food on your plate. Which I thought was interesting, and who knows, maybe that is a way of losing weight.
It did make me feel somewhat discouraged about my scores of years of therapy.
Right. Well, they hate therapy.
I know.
They think that therapy is a racket.
It is. Well, sometimes it is.
Yeah. Well, I think probably Freudian therapy is a racket. I mean, this is one of the things I look at in the psychopath test. You know, it feels like amateur sleuth territory. But I think CBT, I think cognitive behavioral therapy, works. I'm an advocate of that.
Yeah, but he might be a murderer too.
Yes. Oh, Bandler. Well, he was tried for murder. His coke dealer's girlfriend was shot, and her blood was found all over his shirt, and they arrested him. There were only two people in the house at the time, which means that one of the two was the murderer. It was Bandler and it was the coke dealer. I think his name was James Marino. And each one blamed the other. So Bandler was acquitted. And yes, it's something that people don't really know about him. All these salespeople who are learning Bandler's techniques don't know that they're learning from a guy who was once on trial for the murder of his coke dealer's girlfriend.
It's like a game of Clue, isn't it? Like Bandler in the kitchen with the gun.
I was just looking through, by the way, your list of previous guests, and you've had some great guests. You've had Craig Brown, who's a wonderful British writer, and you've had Jennifer Egan, and you've had Susan Cain. You've had some great guests
in
your time.
I can't believe they would. I can't believe you're talking to me. But
yeah,
I mean,
well, it's what we do. You know, we like to connect with readers.
It's fun. Jennifer Egan got mad at me because I told her that A Visit from the Goon Squad was not a really good title. But I said,
it's not a good title.
Yeah, but because it's from Elvis Costello. And I said, people, even in the book, she says the guy didn't know what it meant. So I thought, well, no one who reads, you know. But anyway, I said, she won the Pulitzer Prize for it. So I said, what I did say was, I said, why don't you write another book with a lousy title? You might win the Pulitzer Prize again. Which,
okay,
it just
yeah,
popped out of my mouth. And then she got really mad, which I don't believe.
That's going to warm you to an author. And she was wrong. I love her book, but she was wrong about the greatest pauses in rock and roll.
I know. I know.
Because she missed out what is the greatest pause in rock and roll.
All right. I played her the best pause in rock and roll. What's yours?
It's and now I hope for your listeners you're going to actually play this now, right? Do you promise me if I tell you, you'll play it?
If I knew anything about how to work radio, I'll play it, yes, but
okay.
I can't play it now.
It's Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile by Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel.
Okay, I'm writing it down.
Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile, best pause in music. So what do you think is the best pause in music?
Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys.
Yeah, not so bad. Oh, and Young Americans by David Bowie.
Yeah, right.
I remember she mentions that one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. What was I going to tell you about that? What were we talking? We were talking about that, and then talking about pauses in rock and roll. I don't know. Anyway, what I was going to say, too, is like in that Talking Ted and also in Psychopath Test, I was going back to what I read. When you and I do exactly the same thing, now it's the DSM-5. They got rid of Asperger's disease. I don't know why.
Yeah, well, it's not out yet. It's going to be out in May.
Yeah, but anyway, I go through that, and I have everything in there. I've always done that. I did it before you did it.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think everybody does it. I didn't realize when I was doing it that this is very much something that an awful lot of people do. I mean, I've got at least 12 mental... I've diagnosed myself with at least 12 disorders from the DSM. One I've definitely got, no question, and that's nightmare disorder, which is categorized if you have recurrent dreams of being pursued or declared a failure. And all my dreams involve me being pursued and declared a failure.
Okay.
By people who are pursuing me.
Here's the...
I'm basically running down the street, somebody's pursuing me and yelling, "You're a failure." So I've definitely got nightmare disorder.
Okay, here's my seminal dream of failure.
Right.
I'm in this beautiful house, and they say when you dream about a house, you're dreaming about your subconscious. But
right.
So I'm in this beautiful house, and there's this guy that looks like Gandalf, and he's got long
right.
white beard, and he's got a cape and a staff and a cloak, not a cape. And he takes me up. I've lived in this house all my life, and he takes me upstairs, and there's this room that I've never seen before. And it's locked, and he takes this ornate key from his pocket and unlocks it. And inside are these shelves and shelves and shelves of these beautiful, beautiful books bound in Morocco leather, blue and red and gold. And he passes his hand across the whole room, and he goes, "All of this could have been yours." And
okay, that's not so good. Well, I had one quite recently where I got to visit Downton Abbey, and they all told me that they didn't really like my work.
Well, the thing about your work is that, all right, like say you're talking to Insane Clown Posse, and you do excerpt a review that says their latest album is like the worst album ever created in the history of mankind, which I listened to it and it is. Although I watched one of their music video and somehow it was strangely compelling. I couldn't say why.
Yeah, not according to me, by the way. According to critics, I wouldn't be that you know. Mean about somebody.
But when you do that kind of essay, if these guys were intelligent enough to read it and to understand it, don't you from time to time feel bad if their feelings are hurt because of it?
Yeah, I will always feel bad if I've hurt somebody's feelings. For me, that's not, you know, that's not my intention. That's not the job I'm in. Once in a while, you've got to make a choice between, you know, the reader and the participant. So you've got to, once in a while you have to make a kind of decision. Do I leave out this thing because I don't want to hurt the person's feelings, or do I keep it in because it's important for the story? And it's what, you know, so who am I doing this for? Am I doing it for the reader, or am I doing it for the person I've interviewed? Now, I'm not, you know, there's no easy answer to those questions, but it's something that has to go through your mind when you're writing.
Yeah, I think you have a very, actually, maybe it is a disorder that you have, but you have a very good way of divorcing yourself from what might be something that would impede you from saying something in that. You separate that somehow.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I definitely do not want to hurt people's feelings. And in fact, if I hear afterwards that somebody's feelings are hurt, you know, it doesn't make me happy. You know, you'd have to be a kind of monster to be happy about that. Fortunately, it doesn't happen very often. Most of the time, people are very pleased with what I've written. And in fact, when they are and they tell me, I'm delighted. But as I say, you know, my at the same time, my job is not to pander to the vanity of the interviewee. My job is to tell the story, however it unfolded. So, you know, you've just got to be very conscious of that choice and try and make the choice as responsibly as you can on each occasion.
Yeah, but you got to also remember that there's no job description for what you do. You created your own job.
Absolutely. Well, well, that's true. But in a way, the rules are your conscience.
Right.
Which is why psychopaths, you know, can be so terrible and malevolent, because they don't really have any conscience. Your conscience is, you know, that the feelings that our conscience give us, those feelings of guilt and remorse, you know, that's basically the amygdala in your brain working overtime. You know, that's the rule book.
Well, haven't both you and I decided that we're sociopaths anyway?
Oh, I'm definitely not. Definitely not. I'm way too anxious. I'm very anxious. And psychopaths or sociopaths don't have anxiety.
So do you believe in, like, so your anxiety, suppose you were prescribed or went to a doctor who prescribed Xanax or Klonopin or something like that for you, would you consider taking that, or would you rather
be... Well, I've taken Valium in the past, but I don't have any now, so...
should I get you some?
So if I had an anxiety attack now, I would just have to, you know, deal with it.
Have you ever had panic attacks?
Yeah, I've had panic attacks. I'm never quite certain really what the difference between a panic attack and an anxiety attack is. They're sort of cousins, right?
I don't really know, except people who have panic attacks always breathe into a brown paper bag. That's all I know.
Oh, right. Well, I don't remember breathing into a brown paper bag. I think probably what little knowledge I have of the difference between panic and anxiety attacks, I think I'm much more likely to have had anxiety attacks. And I do terribly, and sometimes, you know, they'll veer into sort of symptoms of OCD and stuff, but not anywhere near as badly as kind of regular OCD sufferers have.
No, I still go back and check the lock on my front door 2 times at least.
Right.
Maybe 3 times.
That proves you're not a psychopath.
I'm definitely I'm borderline personality.
Oh, yeah, okay, well, that's
a good one.
Be good. Now, I probably need to finish because I've got to finish my taxes before my family get home.
You have to finish your taxes?
Yes, I have my taxes to finish.
That reminds me, and I'll let you go. You know, and who killed Richard Cullen? What really bugs me all the time is the fact that, as you said, you know, a financial transaction takes a nanosecond for the banks, but then they let you wait for 3 or 4 days pretending that something has to clear when it doesn't have to clear at all.
Yes, that's certainly what I was told at the time. Interestingly, somebody has subsequently said to me that that's not true for all banks. It might be true for some banks, but not all banks. So somebody gave me some feedback about that later on.
Well, I'm waiting for them to turn down or to make one of my government checks clear, because that's illegal, and then I can file some kind of class action against all of them, but they haven't done that yet.
I should say, by the way, I'm still filing taxes in the United Kingdom. The taxes I am doing now, I will be sending to Britain, even though I'm currently living in the United States. So I think all that's going to change next year. I think I'm going to have to start to learn how to file taxes in America instead of Britain.
So you'd be paying half what you're paying now.
Well, I wonder. I don't know. It's all complicated. This is all still it's complicated. I find it very complicated.
Well, why don't you hire a CPA instead of doing it
yourself? Oh, well, I do. I have an accountant, but I still have to kind of prepare the taxes. I still have to work out how much went on, you know, stationery and how much went on taxes.
Yeah.
So that's basically what I'm doing now.
I've given
so
up
it's
preparing.
It's bookkeeping more than accounting.
I just have a big cardboard box, and then at the end of the year, it's too daunting to look inside of it, so I've decided not to.
Right, okay, well, you see, I feel too much guilt and worry about doing something like that.
All right, well...
Look, I have a huge pile of receipts in front of me, which I will now rustle for you to get through.
Do you have them arranged by month yet, or is it just one big pile?
No, you know what, I'm nearly done. I think if I concentrated for 2 hours, I'd have it done.
All right, well, then I'll let you do that. I could talk to you for hours about, just talking about stuff, but I really have enjoyed it, and thanks so much for bearing with me.
Thank you. No, I very much enjoyed it, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good talking to you.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. That was John Ronson, author of Lost at Sea. He also wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was a great movie with George Clooney and, I guess, Owen Wilson, too. Anyway, we are obviously kindred spirits. His books are hilarious, absolutely hilarious. I just recommended it to a couple of people yesterday who wanted funny books for Christmas for their 50-year-old whatevers. And he's definitely somebody, if he's for you, then you need to read all of his work. And he's one of a kind. So next week we have Carry the One, which is a book by Carol Anshaw, completely different. It's a novel that is based on a tragedy. What happens is there's a wedding, Carmen's wedding, and then three siblings and their friends go out on a car ride and something not good happens. I could tell you because other reviews do, but I'm not going to. And so the next 25 years of their lives, they have to live under the long shadow of this tragedy. And it's funny, through no matter what, through friendships, love affairs, marriage, and divorce, you know, it always resonates with them, and it changes their lives in completely different ways. And, you know, it's not one of the books I would normally pick up, but that's what's so good about the show, is that I'll read books that otherwise I probably wouldn't read because of the cover or because it looks like it might be a girl's book or something like that. But then again, this book was, you know, excellent, just superlative, and I probably never would have seen it but for this show. So I'm happy for the book, Carry the One. I'm happy that I'll get to talk to Carol Anshaw, and I look forward to next week very much. And like John was saying, he was saying, wow, you've got some really good people on your show, when he was listing them. I can't tell you how grateful I am to all of these authors who have taken time out to spend some with me, which has got to be, you know, really, really daunting. Anyway, so the other cool thing is, as I tell everybody, and I wish you guys would do it too, is to like us on Yelp or on Foursquare or on Facebook or on Twitter, because it makes such a difference to us at the bookstore. And, you know, it's whether you like social engine optimization or any social networking at all, it just helps us out so much when you participate in our continuing attempt to keep the independent bookstore alive. So thank you very much for doing that. In any event, once again, this is The Avid Reader. It's brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. It's just off the downtown interchange of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, right off of Route 100 in the lovely community of Eagle View. Follow the purple signs to the town center, which is just above the excellent restaurant Brickside, and right next to the excellent restaurant Nudie's. So I will talk to you next week.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.